Today's episode is sponsored by Morgan Stanley. Just 30 years ago, renewable energy seemed futuristic. Now, it's a practical way to power cities. Morgan Stanley explores the economics driving the industry and what it means for investors. Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/podcast. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
Opening bell in about 20 seconds. Let me just set the stage for you.
Money, money, I want more money.
You cannot have it all.
This whole system is too confusing.
Hi, I'm Ben White, and this is Politico Money. Welcome to the latest edition of Politico Money. We're coming at you from the Politico Women Rule Summit in D.C. this week. So if you hear some noise around us, it's just all of the folks moving around this summit where we're talking about some critical issues on women in the workforce and politics and all aspects of American life. And our guest today is perfect for this topic. Beth Ann Bovino is the chief U.S. economist at Standard & Poor's, one of the highest rated economists on Wall Street. She's got a new report out that suggests that if we did a better job of incorporating women into the workforce, got their participation rate higher, we could have an economy that's $1.6 trillion larger than it is now. We could add 5 to 10% to GDP over 10 years. These are big numbers, and they just show how much damage is done to the economy when we discourage women in the workforce. So we talk about that. We talk about the raft of sexual harassment claims and charges and how that impacts women in the workforce. And we get into the tax cut plan and her views on how that would add to growth and impact the debt and the deficit. So lots of good topics with Beth Ann Bovino, who is a super top flight economist. And we're thrilled to have her and hope that she can shed light on some of these topics for us. So hope you enjoy it. Also, please do subscribe to Politico Money on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to rate us. Give me those stars. Give me your reviews. Always enjoy getting your feedback, positive and negative. Like the positive more, but we'll reflect the negative as you have it. Doing our best to bring you an interesting economic podcast and hope you enjoy Beth Ann Bovino. You've got an interesting report out today that puts some hard numbers on just how much damage is done to the U.S. economy by the lack of having women in more senior jobs across the economy and in the workforce in general, that we are held back as an economy by the way we treat women and the way we have them in or not in the economy. There's a lot of big top line numbers in this thing. Give me just like the top takeaways you found in looking at the role of women in the workforce right now.
Sure. So what we were looking at is we were trying to get a sense of, first let's take a step back and see where the U.S. economy is. We have the U.S. economy now. Potential growth rate is now, according to S&P's estimates, S&P Global's estimates, it's now at around under 2% potential growth. 10 or 15 years ago, it was closer to 3%. So we're seeing the growth rate slow dramatically. We've also seen a number of people leave the workforce. We now have a labor participation rate near a 40-year low. So we wanted to kind of dive down into what was happening with the labor participation rate, and we focused on women. What we saw there and why we decided to take it even further is that women had been in the workforce, and we saw a real pickup from the 1970s to where, you know, to say the 1990s, but then it sort of stagnated at a certain level, and we were trying to understand what the reasons were.
Right. Okay. And what you found was that, and this is what really interested me, in sort of 1990, the U.S., when compared to other developed nations, was near the top in women participating in the workforce. We are now, I think, according to your report, 20th out of 24, something like that, in the OECD. I mean, we're low.
We're 22. Low.
22. Okay, so we've gone from near the top in women participating in the workforce to near the bottom over a course of, I guess that's 17 years. So, or is that 27 years? My math skills are obviously, I should be talking about the economy here when I can't do math. But let's talk about that drop from near the top to the bottom, or close to the bottom. What happened?
Well, I guess one example is the U.S., I believe, is the only country in the OECD that doesn't provide income support during maternity and paternity leave. And that's just one example. If it costs a lot, you're going to do, as a woman who's taking care of children, you're going to do a cost-benefit analysis. Is it worth it to get that paycheck when over 50% goes to childcare? Maybe I'll just stay at home.
Yeah, which is interesting. I mean, we are the only developed country that doesn't require employers to provide coverage when you're out for the birth of a child. We do not have mandated, maternity or paternity leave. And, you know, there was some talk in this latest tax reform, tax cut bill, and we'll get to that and the broader implications of that, but of trying to address that in here. And there is a provision that's a limited one that would offer some tax incentives to companies that provide paid family leave, but it's far from mandating that employers do it. I mean, that seems to me like, from a public policy standpoint, the obvious thing to do is just get with the rest of the world and say, you know, we are going to pay you when you go and have a child and you come back and your job is there, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, well, let's see what happens. But that seems to be one possible way to make it easier for women who have or want to be in the workforce, to make it easier for them to stay, to retain their jobs and to stay and also climb that corporate ladder. Now, we understand that the choice of staying in the workforce or choosing to take care of children, it's a choice. There's other factors, cultural, family reasons that women choose to. But, you know, if a woman wants to stay, let's make it easier for them.
Yeah.
I would add one more thing, though, and it's not an area that we really talked about in the report, but another factor that might make it a little harder for women to stay in the workforce is the so-called marriage tax. If you have a couple married, made the same amount as two single people, well, there's a marriage tax there. They're paying a little bit more in taxes. So if Congress is talking about tax reform, maybe they could talk about that as well.
Marriage penalty, yeah, absolutely. So I want to get to your story a little bit, how you got to where you are in a, you know, what is one of many kind of male-dominated fields in economics and on Wall Street. But let's do a couple of more numbers before we do that. And that is your contention in this report that over the next couple of decades, if we did a better job of getting women in the workforce and helping them move up the ladder, get equal pay, all of the various things that folks are working on, if we did that, you could see an additional GDP growth of, I think you put it at 5 to 10% over a period of decades, and that the economy would be 1.6 trillion larger. Talk to me a little bit about the opportunities here. Like, if we did a better job of integrating women into the workforce, promoting them the way they should be promoted, how much better could our economy be doing?
Sure. So what we did was we decided to do a scenario, a what if scenario. So we looked at what happened in the 1970s. In the early 1970s, U.S. women's participation rate was nearly the same as many other countries in the OECD, for example, Norway or other countries. So we'd look at Norway in particular, where we were virtually the same in the early 70s, but Norway took off in terms of women participation, whereas women in the United States, while we did see an increased pace, it certainly was much slower. So what we looked at is, what if women shared the same path, and the United States shared the same path as women in Norway in terms of entering the workforce? What we found was that if women in the United States, the participation rate of women in the United States kept at the same pace as what happened in Norway, we would have today, and as of 2016, we would have seen an economy that was $1.6 trillion larger than it is today. That means, to put it into everybody's pocketbooks, that means $5,000 for each man, woman, and child in the U.S. Seems like it would be worth it. What you talked to about the 5 to 10% additional growth, what we were trying to indicate was that with that extra productivity boost of women in the workforce, and by the way, at a time when we have retirees, baby boomers, leaving the workforce at a very sharp pace, having those women in the workforce over the next few decades, the productivity gains and the competitive edge that we would have would grow the economy even by leaps and bounds, by 5 to 10% going out further.
I want to dig more into the numbers in a couple of minutes, but tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, how you got to where you are. And I'm particularly interested if you faced, you know, challenges as a woman working in economics and in finance. Obviously, it's traditionally been a pretty male-dominated business. Give us a little bit of the Beth Ann Bovino story.
It's kind of a little embarrassing. I dated my adjunct professor, and he was an economist, and I thought I wanted to be an economist. This is after I graduated, but right after, and I said, he's an economist, I want to be an economist. And of course, you know, the relationship didn't work out, but my love for economics continued.
Something very good came out of it. Right.
So I stayed in economics. I pursued it. I got a PhD in economics, and I don't think I would say that I've had any significant nothing that I would, you know, put a headline on, but certainly there were much fewer women in economics back then, and I believe it even today more, but certainly a lot fewer, and that just makes you as a woman want to work just a little bit harder to, you know, to get noticed, to get to put yourself on the map, and I think if anything that made me more successful, but it also was a harder path. I would suggest.
Yeah, and you've been among the top ranked economists on Wall Street for your forecasts over a series of years. Do you feel like you're noticed the way you should be now that your work gets as much, you know, exposure and respect, and is consumed as much as, you know, male economists at some of the bigger Wall Street firms and elsewhere? Like, is the playing field better now than maybe it was in 1980?
I can only speak from my own personal position, but I worked incredibly hard to get to this position. I put a lot of hours in, and certainly that meant a lot fewer hours having fun. But I think there was a couple things. One, there was success. I had good mentors, both male and female mentors, that really helped kind of chaperone me or through these difficult times. And a lot of it also is, you know, I have to say, luck.
Yeah.
I was in the right place at the right time. But I do think that there has been changes for women, positive changes, though I think we still have further to go.
Sure. Let's talk about one area where we have seen some progress. Obviously, the numbers on labor force participation are a bummer and going the wrong direction. But on equal pay, it's better than it was. That I think in your report, you suggest it's sort of 83 cents on the dollar now, women versus men being paid for similar jobs, which is not okay. It should be 100 cents on the dollar, obviously. But there's been some improvement made there in pay equity between men and women, not by any means as much as needs to be made, but some progress has been made. Tell us, where are we on pay equity and what needs to happen to make it even better?
Sure. I would say yes. So you have seen some progress. It used to be, two-thirds.
Yeah.
Women pay was two-thirds to men back, say, 10 or 15 or even 20 years ago. And it's certainly that gap has narrowed, the so-called wage gap, gender wage gap has narrowed. And it also in our report, according to some outside research, for younger women to men, it also has narrowed even further. So that's all very, very promising. But I would say, how can we narrow it further? And one area that we were looking at into was when you look at the type of choices that women and men make in terms of fields of education. And this, I'm not talking about just women. I'm talking going back to girls, girls and boys, in terms of how there seems to be sort of women still it has changed, but women have moved more towards, still move towards more traditional female type roles, whereas men move to more traditional male type roles. Well, if you look, for example, at science, technology, engineering, and maths, that pays more.
Sure.
And it also is highly employable. Women, I think, make up, or 14% of women study that field, half what men do. So not like we don't want to say that, women have a choice in terms of what they do, but we just want to broaden the fields, make those opportunities more available. We would had put, in our report, how many Alberta Einsteins were missed because we didn't open those opportunities for women and girls.
Right. So obviously, an issue there with pay is the lack of women going into some of these more employable, higher paid fields like STEM that you mentioned, and that's a big topic at the Women Rule Conference. And is that a question of policies that need to change on the part of, either academia or the corporate world, or is it more cultural changes that men need to make in terms of, committing to sharing the burden in child rearing and taking time off themselves. I know it's, you know, sort of more popular now to do that, and attitudes towards that have changed somewhat. But I guess what I'm looking for is what piece of this is general cultural change that needs to happen versus policies either at the the federal level or just within corporations themselves.
You know, both need to be considered when we want to look into this. And we were clear in our report that we're not, you know, that there's a lot of decisions that need to be made. Policymakers are still sort of grappling on what the choices were that could be made, but we just wanted to offer a few ideas for them to consider.
Okay. And one of those ideas, which I thought was really interesting, is doing a CBO score. This is the Congressional Budget Office we're talking about that does scores of legislation on how they would impact the debt and the deficit, the budget. They do growth projections. One of the official scorekeepers in Congress of legislation and how it impacts the economy. Your suggestion in the report is to have the CBO score legislation as it impacts the role of women in the workforce. Is this going to help us get more women in the workforce, making more money and making the economy more productive, or is it not going to do that? Which I think would be a really interesting test to apply to the current tax reform bill. But talk to me about that particular suggestion that the CBO take on this new role.
We thought that one possible way to at least to start kind of tackling this issue of making it easier for women to enter the workforce was that what if we came up with some kind of score? I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean it has to come from the CBO, but just some kind of a CBO-like score to assess the impact legislation would have on the economic feasibility and accessibility to the workforce for women. Think about it as a kind of a cost-benefit analysis on the decision to work, taking into account childcare costs. I'm thinking of, say, a legislation. Mm-hmm. What are the cost-benefit analysis on this legislation on a woman's decision to work, taking into account child care costs and other that women have to face? This could be, this could be something that could look into, for example, factoring in if this score like the CBO like score cost benefit ratio could factor in child care costs, but it could also look into the impact of the overall economic economic benefit, including job creation, if more women were to enter the workforce. I would say that this is something that that the CBO has done, or something similar, when you look at the ACA. When the ACA was being enacted, the CBO did an analysis on the impact of jobs.
Talking about the Affordable Care Act here, the Obamacare, basically.
Correct, yeah. So it was when the Affordable Care Act was being initiated back in 2010 or around there, the CBO looked at the impact on job choice. Mm-hmm. And they found that there, I believe at the time, that there would be fewer workers, but it was really about a worker had a choice now. They were, before ACA, they were kind of tied to the job that they had in order to get benefits. Yeah, and now they had more choices. Something similar to that might be interesting.
Yeah, it would be interesting. And I wonder if we applied it to legislation we're talking about on Capitol Hill now, which the main feature of it is to cut the corporate rate from 35 to 20%. There are also reductions for individual taxpayers, particularly in the first couple of years that the bill would be, or the melded bill. Eventually, when there's a House and Senate bill together, you will have tax cuts for individuals for a couple of years. They will probably expire down the road. The Republican talking point on this is if you cut the corporate rate to 20% and you allow repatriation of all of this overseas corporate income at a one-time lower rate, put a territorial system in place where companies pay just pay taxes on their domestic income, and there's a smaller toll gate for foreign income. But anyway, as a whole, their argument is we'll get faster economic growth of up to 3% or more over a 10-year period of time. We won't blow up the debt and deficit, and we'll have a lot faster wages and productivity growth. How much of that do you buy? What is your assessment of how this tax plan would impact the economy starting next year?
So in our own analysis, we do have a 3 and a 4 in our analysis, although that usually follows a 2 and a decimal point. So we don't see right at this point in time. We're not even with a tax package. Maybe not. We've looked at a tax package a little bit smaller than that, but even there, we saw a nice boost, a near-term boost in growth for 2018. For example, if we saw $1 trillion in tax cuts coming back to the United States, both corporate and households, we saw that that would give next year. A nice boost around 3%, but then it sort of falls out after that. We have a long-term participation rate, again, under 2%. It doesn't change with this tax bill. We see that largely because, and there's not too much Congress can do about that, demographics, the aging population, that just slows growth.
Right, slows growth, keeps us at a relatively low labor force participation.
And one of the reasons why we thought, why don't we bring some of these women back
exactly,
to the workforce?
Exactly, right, which sort of ties us back to what we're talking about, which is if you want to address a declining or stagnant, we should say it's not really declining at this point, but it's kind of stuck where it's been, or at a 30-year low, basically, in the labor force participation rate. And if you have baby boomers retiring en masse, which you do, you need somebody else to be coming into the labor force, and obviously that's where women come in. And I sort of want to go back to this thing about Norway, like all we have to do to kind of attain these goals that you're talking about is to just be as good as Norway. Like it feels like that shouldn't be so hard, but what is it that, you know, say a Norway does that we don't, other than paid family leave, mandated paid family leave? Like what else do we need to do to be more like Norway and get more women in the workforce?
Well, it's not just, again, when we did our analysis, it's not just Norway. You have Sweden, you have Canada. Other countries have offered policies that would ease the transition from having a child and then taking time off and then coming back to the workforce. We talk about paid maternity and paternity leave, and the U.S. is the only country that doesn't provide this by law. But what about child care? What about the cost of child care? I'm pleased to hear that the Congress is looking into this when they're talking about tax reform. This could be something that would really help, but let's see how much they can do. You know, a single mother, for example, a full day of childcare for infants could eat up over 40% of her income. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of money that goes to childcare, and money that she and her children need. So this could certainly be one area to improve. Another area could be pre-K. Mm-hmm. This is something that's happening in different parts of the country, but what if that was a national mandate?
National mandate, right, would probably help matters along. We'll be right back with more of my interview with Beth Ann Bovino, but now a word from our sponsor.
A message from Morgan Stanley. Has alternative energy gone mainstream? Alternative energy, solar power investment, and utilities are taking what was on the fringes of science as recently as 30 years ago and turning it into the new normal. Biosphere 2, a massive science facility tucked away in the desert foothills of the Santa Catalina Mountains, was built for controversial space exploration experiments. Now it functions as a mainstream research facility, studying the potential for farming beneath solar panels, a technique that's already applicable for future colonies on Mars. Morgan Stanley's podcast discusses where the renewable energy industry has been, its transformation over the past few decades, and what it means for investors in renewable energy technology, as well as everyday consumers. Hear the full podcast at morganstanley.com/podcast and subscribe to the Morgan Stanley Ideas podcast. Morgan Stanley & Co., LLC, member SIPC.
Another thing we haven't talked about, and it's hard to quantify, I think, at this juncture in economic terms, but is this, you know, rampant problem of sexual harassment in the workplace, another topic that's big at Women Rule this year, obviously, because we hear so many reports both in corporate America, in the media and on Capitol Hill and in congressional races of all of these allegations of sexual harassment against men, which, you know, frankly, depress and disgust me nearly every day when I wake up and read more about it. But, you know, aside from the human toll that this exacts on women, which is tremendous, and then all of the money that has to be paid out in these settlements, there's got to be a much bigger, broader economic impact that we're talking about here, both in terms of women being discouraged from continuing their careers, from not rising to the level that they should rise to based on their talents and abilities. Have you looked at, or what is your sense for the toll that this kind of behavior takes on the U.S. economy? My assumption is it's got to be pretty big.
So in terms of actually, you know, putting a number on this, it's incredibly hard to quantify both the psychological impact on the women and the workforce, in say that workplace, the impact, because, you know, even if it happened to one or two women within a workforce, a workplace, probably the sentiment is felt across the, I guess you could say across the office. And so that has most likely has traumatic impact on morale. And if morale is hurt, that also hurts productivity. It slows down productivity. It probably, I would say that it would probably increase days taken off, yeah, because why would you want to be in that kind of environment? I would say the productivity right now, our productivity levels in the United States are incredibly low. I think productivity growth is now nearing 1%. And that is very bad for the U.S. economy and very bad for people's paychecks. Productivity growth we need that boost, and having people with very depressed morale because mm-hmm. of an environment like that, and also that also adds to the low productivity.
Yeah, and I would think that just in terms of, you know, corporate profitability and general performance, I think there's plenty of statistics that indicate that, you know, the more diversity you have in the executive ranks and in the boardroom, the better decision making happens, the better performance happens. And if you have this kind of culture of sexual harassment, of people, women being discouraged from reaching those levels, you're just going to have companies that perform more poorly. They're just not going to be as good if you have that kind of a climate. I know it's hard to quantify, and you're an economist. You want to put numbers on this, and hopefully at some point somebody will come out with a definitive report on the impact of sexual harassment on the U.S. economy. But, I mean, beyond just the demoralization and the morale at companies, like, it seems to me there's bottom line impact on women in positions of power and decision-making that make these companies do less well than they might otherwise.
Well, I would think that this, you know, we talk, it's again, seeing the headlines over and over and over and over again about sexual harassment at the workplace, and not just in Hollywood, but across the United States and most likely in other countries as well. But we're just focusing on the U.S. right now. It seems an issue of it can't just be one bad apple or two right. bad apples. It sounds like it's a systemic issue. And that goes to your point, Ben, about governance, the question of corporate governance. This is one area that we believe clearly needs to be looked into, because if it's happening at one place, and it just really the question is how far does it go up the chain, right. And even if it's not, we're not saying that it's rampant up at the top of the ladder, but the message needs to be brought down. The message needs to be that this is not okay, and it needs to be changed.
Yeah.
I would add when we talk about kind of climbing the ladder, we talked about women and the women pay gap, and we talked about corporate governance here. I believe you know, we have seen more progress on this. I mean, in terms of women on the board of the board of directors on corporations, but it's still rather low. I think it's in the teens. Yes. It's still rather low.
Yeah, and am I right that, and you may not have this at your fingertips, but that generally speaking, corporate performance is higher when you have a more diverse board, or, you know, women in top executive positions. I feel like I've seen these numbers that bear that out. I don't have them handy, but is that something that you've seen in your work, that it's generally a good thing from a corporate performance perspective to have gender diversity in the boardroom and the C-suite?
Absolutely. We could take this to, it doesn't have to be just gender diversity. It can also be in terms of ethnicity, racial, yeah. all those factors. But when you think about it, you know, women are women in the United States are the a big part of the household pocketbook in terms of spending activities and decision making, and so why not have that voice at the board, because it's really giving a sense of what's happening in the marketplace as well. You have seen change on that, but that's an area that still needs to be developed.
Yeah.
Improved.
One thing I forgot to ask you before I let you go on the tax cut plan is the impact on debt and deficit. There's this big debate going on, Republicans saying we're going to get enough growth to pay for this. It won't actually cost $1.5 trillion. It won't cost us anything. Now, they haven't produced any studies that back that up, and the CBO, JCT, that's the Joint Committee on Taxation, and others have suggested that, you know, even if you factor in a bit faster growth from the lower corporate tax rate, you still get at least an additional trillion in deficits over 10 years. And I've yet to see Republican economists rebut that in anything other than rhetoric. What do you think is the impact on the U.S. debt and deficit of a tax cut of this magnitude?
Well, first, I want to be clear that I'm at S&P Global. I'm the U.S. economist. I do not work with the sovereign analysts.
Sure.
I'm not part of the committee decision, so I just want to be clear on that. I would say that one of the things that we would look as economists that we would look at in terms of the growth potential, if one of the factors that we would look at is basically the growth potential on tax reform. And while we do think tax reform is something that would be a positive for the U.S., we haven't seen it in 31, 32 years. Mm-hmm. And back then, we were largely a manufacturing economy, and now we're more services. So indeed, in terms of tweaking what we have would be a plus in terms of economic growth. But the question of do we see the growth potential that had been discussed among the lawmakers of 3% plus going out in a number of years, we just don't see that. And if we don't see the growth potential, we're not likely going to see the tax revenues to offset the costs.
Yeah, very good. Okay, Beth Ann Bovino, thank you so much for taking the time. I would highly recommend to people to look up The Key to Unlocking U.S. GDP Growth, Women. That's the latest report from Beth Ann Bovino and Jason Gold at Standard & Poor's. Give it a read. It's super interesting. And we really thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that's it for the latest edition of the Politico Money Podcast. Thanks so much to Beth Ann Bovino for joining us. Apologies for any noise that might have been in the background, but I hope you took some things away from that conversation. I certainly learned some things. I'd like to thank my producer for the week, Micaela Rodriguez, who did a fantastic job. Always thanks to Bridget Mulcahy, who is off this week, but will be back with us soon. And thank you for tuning in. Please do subscribe on Apple Podcasts, rate us, write a written review, and we'll be back with you next week.